This is the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast. Your hosts, Sam Harris and Nicholas Farik, digest the most interesting, informative, and topical books, giving you their biggest insights. We expose different perspectives and tools to look at the world to make you wiser than yesterday.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast. My name is Nico. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Sam. And today we're discussing the book Hope in the Dark by Rebecca Solnit. With Hope in the Dark, Rebecca Solnit makes a radical case for hope as a commitment to act in a world whose future remains uncertain and unknowable. Drawing on her decades of activism and a wide reading of environmental, cultural, and political history, Solnit argues that radicals have a long neglected history of transformative victories, that the positive consequences of our acts are not always immediately seen, directly knowable, or even measurable, and that the pessimism and despair rest on an unwarranted confidence about what is going to happen next. And so Sam and I read the new version of the book. It originally was published in 2004, and it now has a new foreword and a new afterword. And so her book is said to be shining a light into the darkness in our time of unforgettable uncertainty. So Sam, what was your experience on the book?
Yeah, I quite like the book. It's a good point worth making. I was on a podcast the other week and they pulled out a quote from me which said that you always need to see the end of the tunnel to know that there is one. So you don't need to see the light to kind of keep on going sometimes, and things can get like really dark, but you just carry on, which I guess sort of is a lot of what this book makes the point about, that you don't always need to have the direct feedback that you've done something good to actually change the world and be doing good. And we all kind of get bogged down in despair and things, which is sort of a useful point to be making, because so much of action does seem to get ignored on the surface, and often you are making a difference. And sometimes if you try to be like a vegan or something, you feel like no one else is doing it, but then actually over the last few years it has really caught on. But it took people to start doing it sort of 30 years ago to sort of keep showing that it was perfectly possible for humans to do this. And yeah, so there's really useful points from that sort of stuff, but I don't know if it needed to be a whole book. Like a blog post probably would have been fine, but I guess the point of a book is you kind of almost need to have books of ideas just to say this is an idea that's worthy of thinking about and that it needs to sell well, just to show that people think about these things. So almost in the elephant and the brain style, you know that other people are thinking about this and that you're not alone in thinking it. It's quite useful. In terms of the actual content that you read, you don't need to read the whole thing. It's more that you've read the book and you know other people have read the book. That's the benefit, I think, of this thing.
That's an interesting point. I've thought about that, where the book is like some kind of concept where people can get behind it. It's difficult to get behind a blog post, right?
Yeah. So it's an idea worth saying that, like, if you're an environmentalist, hey, you've read this book, and you can sort of signify that you're one of these people that's read this book and that you're a useful human and you believe in these things.
Good. My initial impression when reading the book is I think that the premise in itself is pretty good. I mean, it is important to have hope. And I think the author makes a very good point that actions of the few have had a very large impact, although we don't always realize it. So a lot of very important problems from the past have been solved because some individuals and small parties were just stubborn enough to make a change and to fight for it. And so it's a call for activism. And so, but my initial feeling when reading the book was that it was a book aimed at, it sounded very politically charged. And so in my impression, it was written by a very leftist American for other leftist Americans, very liberal. And so, I mean, she is an environmentalist, but she was referring to the Iraqi war and to Bush and to, in general, like right-wing Americans as evil. And I had a hard time really believing into her story just because everything was so influenced politically.
Yeah. In terms of like the Taleb strategy of like timeless books, it definitely doesn't feel that timeless just because of the specific content she references. Whereas the actual idea, just written in a slightly different use of examples, could be a lot more timeless and could have been a book from like 200 years ago that could last for like 1,000 years. But it's definitely in 50 years' time, I just don't see people reading this book so much.
Exactly. This book is very, you know, I don't think it'll even be read a lot in 10 years from now, because it's very actual. very modern. And
yeah, someone would just write the same book with new examples in 10 years time, that would be more relevant.
Yeah. And so for me, I wasn't really convinced by the examples, because she makes or tries to make the case that the world now is worse than it's ever been. And my personal opinion is that it's the opposite. It's actually better than it's ever been, because she talks a lot about inequality. And I used to be very much against inequality, until I became convinced that if everyone goes up, but the inequality goes up as well, inequality isn't necessarily that bad of a thing.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I get that point. As in, the problem is like the mental health side of things, you feel like you have less, which is like a very confusing thing that we have, like in a world now where people are richer than they've ever been, there are more people depressed. So if people are like killing themselves and have an awful life because they feel like they don't have as good a life as they should be, even though they actually have like far more than any human in history, they still feel like bad. So then enjoy what they have, which is more of like, okay, how do you change human psychological root being, which you can't. So in some ways, inequality is really bad on that side of things. But yeah, if there's people not getting raped or like starving to death, then this is certainly always a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, these times have been the least violent ever in the history of all humankind, right?
Mm, definitely.
You're the least likely to die of anything that is not unnatural in a way, you know?
Yeah.
Like violence and these kind of things.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly, like, the news just doesn't help these things at all, because of the news is any bad news, which is interesting how, like, now that we've got the coronavirus, that there's no other news, because there's no other news really worthy of talking about, because of this is actually something that's actually newsworthy, and the stuff that normally feels as scary is just not that important and no one cares about right now.
So, yeah, I mean, it just made the book a lot less believable for me. Just the fact that it portrays the current situation, or the situation a few years ago, as horrible and bad and very dark. While I think it's been pretty good for most of the people on Earth. I'm not saying it's good for everyone.
If you read it at the time, it might feel relevant and like there's lots of bad things. But 10 years later, you're already like, well, it wasn't that bad. And it's still not that bad. And so it seems a bit silly. Whereas I guess if you wrote the exact same thing just with like more current things, you're going, oh, these are the worst things, just because that's what's on your news, you feel like this is the worst thing and it seems more relevant. So yeah, it has kind of just already dated itself by just talking about things that in a manner that clearly weren't as bad as they were, perhaps. But anyway, let's move into the points that are useful, besides just sort of maybe talking about why it wasn't great. So she starts with talking about the importance of good and bad news, and that like engagement requires the ability to perceive both. So as in, she does say that, you know, we mainly just focus on all the bad news, which is what I was just saying actually, and that we need to celebrate the small successes and the big successes of the things that are going on a lot more. I think it helps people appreciate the good that's going on in the world and more likely to get involved in it, which is a problem with society for sure. And I think potentially the coronavirus is helping with that, because a lot of people just want to hear good news right now, and so there is a amplification of good news just in sort of personal sharing, and like on news like websites and things there is a bit more good news. And then I'm subscribed to a thing called like Good Good Good, which is like a newsletter that's only got good news in it, but I've shared it a few times and so many people sort of thanked me and like subscribed, so I feel like good news sources are growing just as a result of this. So hopefully that carries on into the future and people start focusing on useful things they can do.
So do you feel that in general, people are pessimistic these days?
Well, it depends about what you mean. Just related to right now with the good news, or just people in general?
I would say people in general, like let's say now with the coronavirus. So we're like 6 weeks in.
Yeah, there's a mix. There's people that are just super annoyed about it. People that are worried about losing their jobs. People kind of, there's a weird amount of people that, you know, started protesting about the lockdowns and things. And I've got some neighbors that just seem to think it's all our government's fault and that like they shouldn't be locked down. It's their right for freedom. And like there's the people in America that have been parading for freedom to just go out and stuff. So there's people pessimistic about all of this and it's not that bad. Just strange. But yeah, there's lots of people who are also kind of optimistic but kind of want bad things to happen in the long term, hopefully that maybe there's some goods in, like they maybe just don't really like the way the world's working and it's a bit boring, and like this is like the first newsworthy epic thing that's happened in our time, and they're kind of hoping it gets a bit worse in some way, so that's sort of like, yeah, I did something that was really cool and hard, rather than like if this is going to be the worst thing, it's hardly like the scale of World War II or something to have lived through and sort of talk to our like grandchildren about, oh, well, this was an amazing epic time that we lived through, and you know nothing. We're like, well, yeah, we stayed indoors for like a few months, and we still got to eat like olives and all the things that we like, and yeah, it was fine. And then we went out again, and that's it. That's doesn't sound that impressive. Whereas if like, yeah, economies go completely nuts and lots of people die and these things, are suddenly like, oh, well, that's a story to tell. And yeah, there's definitely people that are kind of almost hoping that things really change from what I've noticed.
Yeah, I think staying indoors for a few months puts things in perspective, right? How easily we start taking, you know, our normal luxuries for granted.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you had told people that I had to shelter during the world wars, how bad we had it these days, they'd be laughing in their faces, you know?
Definitely. So,
yeah. I'm personally of the opinion that we shouldn't complain. And I also think that objectively speaking, from a perspective of our like species, this is a good thing, you know? We were lucky to have something like Corona, which is not super impactful on our health, you know? It's not as deadly as the Spanish flu was.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's sort of like the most beneficial level of like, if there's a graph of deadliness to impact, it's sort of at the perfect places and going to kill the least amount of people to shock the world into actually going into lockdown and realizing that it can completely change the way we do things and that our economies are too fragile and need to be changed and that humans can just stay indoors and not go anywhere if they needed to and just sort of completely change all the rules that you thought were theirs. And like, you'd never imagine different countries going into lockdown and all these kind of things. It's like, that's just, that happens in North Korea, like nowhere else, like in the free world. You realize that, okay, if the climate change is going to really fuck us up, like actually it's worth spending some money right now to deal with these things. So yeah, certainly in this dark moment is giving us a lot of hope in many ways, such as is the title of the book.
Yes. Going back to the book, I found it very difficult to read after having read Taleb.
Yeah.
It's a very different way of writing. And I was constantly being reminded that Taleb would be extremely critical of all of a lot of the points that the author was making in Hope in the Dark. Although I do think that the book is another example of one of the concepts that Taleb explains in his books, which is called the minority rule. If you listened to the previous episode where we discussed the book Skin in the Game by Nassim Taleb, the minority rule is as follows. So if a minority of the population, and by minority he says 3-4%, is extremely stubborn in something, they can actually influence the choices of the whole population. And so an example for that is halal eating. If you have a population of 100 and 3 or 4 people only want to eat halal, you'll see that over time, most of the food that is served to the entire population becomes halal. Because people that only eat halal will not go to a restaurant, for example, that doesn't serve halal. But people that don't care if whether food is halal or not will also go eat at a place that only serves halal.
Yeah, and if they're eating with their mate that's halal, they can't go to the ones that you can't go to.
Yeah, exactly. And so the book Hope in the Dark was for me a list of examples of the minority rule where a very, very few people become so stubborn and so adamant in their point that they actually have a very big impact on the global population.
Yeah, I think, well, in that terms of like activists and stuff, it does make you wonder about the small percent of people that make all of their money from oil and that kind of stuff have had the greatest impact on us for now. But if like this potential like oil crisis and things shows that they can't always make money in the long term, that the governments will actually start thinking, wait, this is a really fragile way to be helping these people if they can kind of screw us over. If we need to have like a more sustainable long-term strategy of energy, and if we need to be getting jobs that are like long-term sustainable, actually we need to be investing in other ways to make this. So it's kind of good. And obviously we've had climate activists and stuff being like the 3% for a long time, but hasn't fully taken off. Whereas, yeah, there have always been people that are like allergic to milk and stuff. That's why like soya and stuff is in place for your milk alternatives and these things. But it's been interesting because I mean, my mum's always been allergic, so she's always had it, but it's been quite bad. And like, we never wanted to get involved with what she was having for most of our lives. And the last 10 years, it's just suddenly changed so much. And it's like, now we kind of just generally just eat soya yogurts and like different milks when we can. My dad, who stubbornly just doesn't want to, so we still always have milk in the house because of my dad. Again, the minority rule. And yeah, strange. Yeah, what examples were you specifically thinking of in the minority rule?
Yeah, mostly. So she was part of a lot of activist groups that for example, fought against the nuclear testing in the US. So she did that, and she pulls up a lot of examples of small minorities who make very big changes or influence very big changes just by not giving in. And so I think you rightly said that the minority role is a two-cutting sword. So on one hand, it can be used for good. And on one hand, it is being used and it will continue to be used for bad as well, right? There's a lot of very rich individuals with a lot of skin in the game and a lot to lose who will keep influencing general policies for the negative, you know, for the whole population.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I think it's just the point is to keep in mind that even you and your social group around you can have a significant impact if you're dedicated enough. And I think that's what the book argues.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, she's got like a nice quote that after a rain, mushrooms appear on the surface of the earth as if from nowhere. Many do so from a sometimes vast underground fungus that remains invisible and largely unknown. What we call mushrooms, mycologists call the fruiting body of the larger and less visible fungus. Uprisings and revolutions are often considered to be spontaneous, but less visible long-term organizing and groundwork or underground work laid the foundation. So it doesn't take a lot of people to kind of just be around ready. So if there's like 2-3% of people in the population ready to kind of lead a bunch of people that suddenly get angry about something, you then get like this huge thing. So she talked about like the Arab Spring is a extraordinary example of unpredictable change of how this happened, but it was sort of ready to happen for a very long time. And these things could be the same with climate change and this kind of stuff that, I mean, already we had the examples of like Greta Thunberg suddenly getting like millions of people to kind of just go on strike from schools and work, which is a good sign, but maybe there's something much bigger that needs to happen.
I was thinking how to apply this minority rule and what the author argues to, for example, your case, because you are vegan, right?
Vegetarian. Vegan mostly at home, but like not enforced on people.
I think that potential strategy for you to, because one of the reasons you don't eat meat is for the environment, correct?
Yeah.
So if you would want to make sure that less meat is being consumed, which would be good for the environment, I think one of the potential strategies for you to like would be to create a movement where as a vegetarian or vegan, you don't go to places that serve meat at all. Because right now you are way too tolerant, right? You're like, okay, I'll go for dinner with people. And if they eat meat, that's okay. You're not stubborn enough in your views on the effect of meat consumption on the environment. I myself a meat eater, and I do like myself a nice piece of meat quite often, to be honest. So I'm talking against myself here, but I think one practical application of the theories of the book and then the minority rule would be something like that.
But it depends on, in the same way that in terms of how people react, sort of like I'm perfectly happy with people who are religious, but if they try and make me do exactly what they do, I get pretty pissed off, kind of sort of thing. And you kind of need to be accepting in the same way, I guess, as if you do believe that everyone should like not eat meat, but then your friends feel like you're judging them. And that's why people kind of get quite angry. Like, yeah, it's sort of very divisive. And if it's easier to just get along with vegans when you are vegan and sort of not worry about food at all. It does certainly change a bit of your friend things, but it's, yeah, sort of awkward one to be in the world if you want to actually be in it and engage with it. But certainly like, yeah, if my friends ever like want to go to like a steak restaurant or something, it's always like, can we just go somewhere else? Like, I mean, anywhere else? And often they'll have like a really nice vegetarian thing anyway. They go to one a few years ago where it had like a really nice cauliflower. And it was a stupidly expensive restaurant as well. So the bill came to like 300 quid for 4 people. And my dinner was £10. And I'm like, guys, you can split the bill and here's my dinner. Like, because fuck that. Like, no one wants to be the dick that doesn't sort of just like dive into things, but if you're gonna spend that much money on meat, like, hey, I'm having no part of that. It's ridiculous.
That's fair. No, but I think you make a good point. I think for you to push through your beliefs and try and influence people and influence in general meat consumption, it would be hard for you, and you would step on people's toes, right?
Yeah. So I'd prefer to kind of almost make it more attractive. As in, it's great to get people to come along to things, as in if it's your birthday, you say, hey, we're going to this really nice vegan place that is really, really nice. And then they get to try and go, oh, this is not bad kind of thing. But there's always one person there that complains like, well, this sausagey thing is still not real meat. And they get pissed off. Same in my household, like my mum doesn't give a crap if she eats like a veggie sausage or a real sausage, but my dad just spends the entire time talking about it being like cardboard or something, even though it's like tasty. And sometimes you give him these things and it's like a whole vegetable dish, but it has a vegetable and it's like, oh, this is lovely. But then as soon as it's the one that's supposed to be replacing his meat, he gets annoyed.
Yeah. I think people in general are resistant to change. Mm. And it's the point of activists, I think, to be so stubborn that they influence others to try it.
Yeah, yeah. Which is why, like, with the vegan movement, they're just trying to make it really cool, basically, and they're saying why it's so much better for your health and as well as the environment and all the other things. And there's been some really big videos with, like, a lot of influencers, like, you know, DiCaprio and whatever you call him, racing driver. Anyway. Mm-hmm. Cool people that like people want to be like them, talking about how good it is. And like, I think it's an entire like American rugby team that have gone vegan now or something. And
wow.
It's definitely a lot of influencers pushing on these things.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good thing. I think personally for me, if I would ever stop eating meat, it'd be from an ethical perspective.
Yeah.
The animals that get killed and...
Yeah, I watched a really interesting documentary on the Faroe Islands where they kill lots of whales, even though they only kill whales that are actually very abundant and not like endangered at all. But people hate watching the videos of them on the beach sort of killing these whales and blood going everywhere, and it's called disgusting. But it's sort of like it's a sustainable way of them living, and the whales die really quickly and sort of ethically kind of thing as far as they're concerned. But people don't like it, even though they go around eating so much meat and other things, they just get killed in like just as ethical a way, basically. And it's like, well, how can we judge them on what they're doing just because if we like this animal as a cute thing as far as our minds are concerned? And maybe we should just all stop eating meat if that scares us so much. And like, if you're just as an alien and you came down and saw like us killing these other animals, you'd be like, well, that's pretty brutal and disgusting. And if you had to go and kill the cow yourself, a lot less people would do it, kind of thing.
Yeah, cognitive dissonance, I think the term is for that. Anyway, let's get back to the book again.
Cool.
I'm curious to know your key takeaway. What will you remember from this book?
I definitely was more inspired to be a bit more forceful with my veganism, having just spoken about this and vegetarianism. And like, yeah, if I sort of, like when I had my leg thing, I kind of stopped eating meat for a while. And it was very hard to push myself back into being like a forceful vegetarian with my family and things. And just remembering that actually, yeah, it does make a difference is when there are a lot of people kind of looking for like that little bit of nudge to kind of do something. And if you are being vegetarian, like I don't really acknowledge how much I've changed my friends, but I have, you know, a lot of friends that were kind of thinking about vegetarian, they're kind of living with me for a month or something, so just decided to go vegetarian in that month, and they haven't really acknowledged it that much that doing it does have an effect on people. And yeah, it did inspire me to like, actually, yeah, I am making a difference, and that it is worth doing these things that seem like they're doing nothing. So that really helped. And yeah, just all that has talks about news, but we're supposed to talk about one thing, so that was my one big takeaway.
All right. From my side, I think because she paints the world as such a horrible place, and I don't really believe in that point, I don't think, like, I think it's a pretty forgettable book from my point of view. So I think in a few months, if you'd ask me some points from the book, I'll know the main premise, but the details I'll have completely forgotten. So yeah, especially after reading something as influential on my beliefs and views of the world as the Incerto series by Nassim Taleb, I think this is a very forgettable book. So. Honestly, I'm not going to take away a lot. I think for me, one of the most important points was the one that you talked about, where change doesn't happen instantly. So, for example, the bigger revolutions, the one of the, you know, the falling of the Soviet Union and the Arab Spring, that there were already some activists who were under the ground, working hard, influencing people, in general, being activists. So we never hear about those, but it's good to know that these kind of major shifts and events don't happen like that. There's always some people working on that for a long time.
Yeah, so she makes a nice point about like feminism, as in some people were really, really vocal and out there and got like arrested and like loads of bad things happened to them to kind of push the feminism movement in the direction that they went to. But like 30 years later, when the vote actually came in and so things started being fair, and no one went back and thanked the people that had been put in jail or anything, and sort of they sort of kind of remained as these sort of people that you mostly forget about and stuff. And does take these people kind of to do these thankless tasks and really go out there to start these things happening, which was
true.
An interesting point.
Absolutely. All right. Any other remarks you want to give on the content?
Yeah, there were a few other news things that she sort of spoke about that I thought were really nice. One was that we should just always keep the priorities as relevant as possible. So on every piece of news, there should be just a banner above it saying, there is a climate crisis. Below is some other news that is less important. And you're like, yeah. that would be great if that happened in the world. And then something relevant for right now is she talks about like the happily ever after effect, that like, Americans are very good at responding to a crisis, but then going home to let another crisis brew, because we imagine that the finality of death can be achieved in life. It's called happily ever after in a personal life, saved in politics. The second half of the sentence is a bit more vague, but the point is that like we're very immediate, and you know, like we respond to the COVID pandemic straight away, but we kind of knew about the problems beforehand and didn't really think that there was anything bad coming, in the same way that is the potential issue with climate stuff, is that we only respond to like immediate things, and because climate's never going to be an immediate thing, we're always like, well, we can kind of not spend money on this right now because there's this other immediate problem that's in the news that we're not thinking about the long-term problems. And yeah, she just goes further to say this whole lack of long-term view is just perpetuated by the media, whose kind of raw material of selling stuff is like the most important news that we'll read right now, even if it's not the actual most important thing. So the thing that just goes into our perception, which is an interesting thing effect in terms of like a month ago, I think more people were scared by the coronavirus than now, even though right now, as we're talking, like in our countries, we're probably at peak pandemic level in terms of right now. If you go outside, it's the most dangerous point in the entire history of the pandemic. There's more people with coronavirus than there ever will be in your country. And yet we're kind of already thinking about, oh, I wonder how we're going to open up our strategies, and like we're not worried about food anymore, we just go to the supermarket when we feel like it, kind of thing. And people are just sort of getting a lot more relaxed and a bit bored, like they're not really listening to the news as much, even though this is like what all the scary news was about and leading us to, was like this moment right now that we're in, and we're not even that bothered right now anymore. It's just funny the way we kind of acclimatized really quickly to this, and yet like, so when we constantly have stuff telling us about like the climate crisis, it just gets really boring straight away because of nothing sort of really going on. And yeah, we are right now in the thing that we were warning about 20 years ago, where we're getting to this point where like if we don't do something, we're really going to fuck ourselves over, and we're still not really like, well yeah, that was news 20 years ago and like we've heard about it, and like now we're actually here. It's just sort of already a bit bored and you're thinking about these other things. So that was another point I thought worth mentioning.
That's true. I was, while you were talking, I was trying to think of a reason why people are so much more inclined to discount threats with time. So like a threat in a week from now is way less important than a threat now. And it's probably, I mean, the first logical reason for that would be from an evolutionary point of view, where if you see a tiger, you have to run away. And only a small percentage were like long-term threats, where you had to plan in advance and think about threats that might come to you. So perhaps there is the reasoning for our inability to think ahead.
Yeah, well, you think as an evolved species, we'd actually move more and more long-term as we're actually, we have less immediate problems. But if you think more about our lineage from before us, like initially like single-celled organisms, literally just all they did was react to like the chemicals in their environment kind of thing. We just like slowly progressed versions of that. And like our brain has developed a lot more, but it hasn't developed so far as to become like an ultimately wise species. Whereas if we were aliens looking down on the planet right now, this wise species that's sort of able to do things, we just look at us and be like, what the hell is a species doing? That's so retarded. Like we have all these weird things and they're not helping each other. Just constantly sort of trying to win the most for themselves. And it's really stupid the way we act as a species, if you think about it. And
For me, it reflects the point made in the book, Why Buddhism is True, where we're basically just machines reacting to external inputs and stressors, where we think that we think rationally about things, but in the end, our decision-making is not that much different from the one like people that lived thousands of years
ago. Yeah, it's just super emotional, really. Yeah, and so, I mean, it's the whole case about like kids and their homework, or like when you're at uni and sort of, it's like the last 2 days where you do your thesis kind of thing, even though...
That's me.
Yeah, you've got the whole like, coming up to a point where you could be working on it sort of 6 hours a day for sort of 2 weeks and then it'd be done. And nothing would happen, but you need the finality of like, this is the deadline, you have to do it right now. And that's when humans just sort of do their work. But there is no deadline on the climate crisis. It just sort of gets worse and worse and worse, but there's no like, this is the stopping point.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that we've passed the point of no return already, right?
So, yeah, but you can never acknowledge that because we have to keep on doing things. And depends, as in there's always this, the potential for science to come up with something crazy that just sort of really solves everything. So we can never be past the point of no return.
True.
Because if we make nuclear fusion and we have like great materials for storing energy and carbon, then even when we've gone past where we should have, you could hypothetically have a technology that just harvests carbon and then buries it, and then like, so everything's fine. And we've kind of stopped looking at geoengineering strategies because of like people think of the ethics of we should just be focusing on carbon reduction, but it's still very possible that even if the rest of the world doesn't agree with it, that China could still do geoengineering because they want to and just keep us below the temperature limits for a while until we can then fix stuff. So it would be better to just fix stuff straight away. And also, it could always go a little bit wrong. But if it gets to the point where like the risk is better than the other risk, then it's still like the better thing to be doing.
That was a good point. A reason for hope, I guess.
Yeah, great.
All right, should we do ratings?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I guess 4.
Wow. I'd have expected you to give more.
Yeah, I was tempted to give like 5 or 6. I just don't feel... I'm very thinking in the long-term mindset. So it was useful to read, I think, in terms of some of the ideas. Good, but just like the way it's written and the timing. It's like, also not being American, I think, makes me think that like, yeah, if like 100 years time, yeah, you're just not going to think about this book that much. So my long-term view is that it's not a useful addition to humanity as much as it could have been.
Yeah. All right. I agree with you on your points. For me, I prefer to have read this as a blog post, but I think that the whole concept, the whole point was something that is, I mean, I'm kind of optimistic person anyway. So it's not really, I didn't really need the book. And so my score is 3. Yeah, I think it's a forgettable book from my point of view. But I'm sure that, and I also noticed I read some comments and a lot of people love the book and need the book.
Yeah, it's a really good point for discussion. So it was interesting to discuss with you and certainly my other friends that are like climate-y stuff. It's a nice thing to have read and then talk about with them. And that it is a book makes it easier to discuss because you spend so much time just in this one thing. Whereas if it was just a blog post, it just wouldn't have the same value.
True.
So yeah, in that sense, it's good. And I would certainly recommend it to my friends that are into climate-y things.
Yeah, I don't think I would. I've been recommending the Incerto series to everyone.
Oh yeah, 100%.
not gonna tell them to read this one.
Anyone that I think will sort of take the leap of faith, I always recommend Why Buddhism Is True as well. Just such a silly title, but otherwise I'm like, it's the best book ever.
Yes, fully agree. Cool. So that was this episode. Next episode, we're going to be discussing philosophy. So we've been inspired by the love of Nassim Taleb for the ancients and the elders. And so we'll now start a series on the old philosophy book ranging from Plato to whatever else he has on the list. I don't know by heart, but
is this Taleb's list that we're reading?
Yeah, I think I
was wondering who made this list that you sent me. Cool. Yeah, it's got some good things in it. Yeah. Also inspired by just like, it's been really nice to do a series on something. As in, like, we got a lot more from just reading all of Taleb's book, which all kind of tie into one bigger story and like reading just a specific set of philosophy that kind of have different concepts that probably tie together. It's really nice rather than random. So I think in general, we're going to try and always do stuff in series.
Yes, that makes sense. Concepts. Because one more last point that I would like to make on that is that I just finished the editing on the first book in the series, Incerto, Fooled by Randomness. And in retrospect, I appreciate it way more after having read the whole series. So I remember like we were like, after reading the first book, we were like, oh, this is heavy and tough and... Okay, bear with us for the next books. And then like at the end, we were like, oh, this was the best series ever.
Yeah, definitely.
So it really true. Influences. So it makes sense to make series about things. All right. So that's what we're going to do. See you next week. And thanks.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. As you know, we are doing this to try and help you get smarter. Well, I have another project for podcast listeners just like you who want to be smart. Nico and I learned so much from reading the same things together and discussing them, and I wanted there to be a tool that made it easy for anyone to listen to the same podcasts and books together with their friends. So I'm building the app Syncify, which does just that. it connects you with your friends in the app, listen to the same things at the same time, or create shared playlists and work through them at your own pace. You can share comments and highlights of your favorite bits, and become smarter by seeing what your friends think around the same content that you enjoy. As a bonus, it also helps with your mental health and reduces isolation. Personally, I hate publishing my life on social media, which I find all rather antisocial, and I don't go out of my way to phone a friend for no reason other than the fact I feel lonely. But I do love doing things with other people, and having my friends listen to the same things is really awesome. I mean, I used to speak to Nico like once a year before we started this book club together, and now we talk all the time because we're just doing something together. So do yourself a favor and sign up for the Syncify app at syncifyapp.com, and I really hope it helps. Thanks a lot for listening. If you enjoyed the show or learned anything new, be sure to share it with your friends. And I just can't tell you how great it is if you were to happen to leave a review on iTunes. These really do help quite a lot. If you have any questions or books that you'd like us to read, feel free to reach out to us through the website, wiserpod.com, or reach out to us on LinkedIn. And just keep loving and keep learning, and ideally, keep listening. Big love from Sam and Nico, and the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast.